Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Dr. Anna Murad, the previous TIPQC Infant Medical Director. Today we have Dr. Brady Creech joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Just going to give a quick introduction. Dr. Betty Creech is the E.D. Carroll Johnson Chair and Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. There, he serves as the director of the Vanderbilt Vaccine Research Program. He leads a clinical and translational research team that is addressing important infectious diseases across the lifespan. His team focuses principally on the clinical development of new vaccines, diagnostics, and therapeutics, while also ensuring that those we currently have are safe and effective. His team's work spans pneumonia, musculoskeletal infections, influenza, Staph aureus, C. difficile, pertussis, RSV, and COVID. Dr. Creech has made his disclosures known and are available in show notes. Before we get started with this conversation, we will reaffirm our value of shared decision-making with parents and patients who we serve and the mission of TIPQC to provide evidence-based information utilizing the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for immunizations. So welcome again. We are so impressed with all of your work. Tell us a little bit about how you got started in vaccine research.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So it probably starts by wanting to be a pediatrician. And that started when I was like 8 years old. And my mom was diagnosed with lupus. And I told her in my little eight-year-old voice that I'd one day find a cure for lupus. And I'm so not doing that. I didn't realize that I was picking like the hardest thing in the world to find a cure for. But you know, I was good at science and I liked medicine. So that was what I did. When I was coming up in college and then in med school, I just did a bunch of stuff around kids. I worked at camps and worked in youth groups and just liked being a pediatrician. But a couple of experiences stand out. I had really great mentors in medical school that happened to be infectious diseases specialists. And I loved taking care of kids that were typically healthy, but had an acute event that really threatened their health. And watching them bounce back from that was really incredible. But then I started to see that this adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, rather than knowing how to treat meningitis really effectively, wouldn't it be great if we could prevent it altogether? And so I came to Vanderbilt because of a mentor, and that was Kathy Edwards, who is one of the leading vaccinologists in our country and is responsible for most of the vaccines that we have on our immunization schedule. So it was around that time that my dad passed away from a heart valve infection. That probably solidified things even more for me in infectious diseases. And I just loved the idea that we could prevent infection before it ever happens. That gets me pretty excited. So that's why I do what I do, I think.
We get everybody pretty excited, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing thing to be able to do. So TIPQC operates mostly in the perinatal health arena. So I do want to start asking about vaccinations, immunizations, protections that we can offer during this very vulnerable time period. So let's start with RSV vaccine for pregnant women. Tell us a little bit about that and why it's important for us to consider it.
Yeah, RSV is so super annoying. For most of us, when we were coming up, RSV is one of the biggest things that we learned to take care of in the wintertime. And being on the wards as an intern in November, December, I mean, that was rough. There were so many little happy wheezers that needed some oxygen, needed some fluids. They'd stay in the hospital for 24 to 36 hours. And up until the recent last couple of years, RSV has always been the number one cause of hospitalization for infants, not anything else. It's RSV. And the problem with RSV is it's different than like measles or other big viruses where once you get it and you get over it, you're immune for most of your life, if not the rest of your life. RSV is very different. You can get RSV a couple of times a year. You can get it year after year. As adults, we still get RSV, but it's at the extremes of life or the extremes of health that we have troubles. So if we're early infants or if we're older adults Or if we have underlying neurologic, cardiovascular, or pulmonary problems, that's when we start to get into trouble with RSV, or if our immune systems are altered because of cancer chemotherapy or something like that. So now, for the first time over the last 3 to 4 years, we've had brand new products that are exceedingly effective in making RSV something that our interns don't even learn about in the hospital very frequently, because those kids aren't coming into the hospital. So we can vaccinate moms, we can give babies a monoclonal antibody, and we can give vaccine to older adults. And in many countries, maternal immunization has been the cost-effective strategy that they have decided to pursue, because it protects two for the price of one. You give mom a vaccine that targets the outside coating of RSV. That vaccine has been shown to be both safe and effective in the third trimester of pregnancy to prevent RSV in the mom, but more importantly, to transfer antibodies over to the baby, just as all of the other nutrients and antibodies are being transferred over. So maternal immunization, mom getting an RSV vaccine during the third trimester, is a super effective way to prevent RSV in the baby.
And you read my mind about the next question, which is basically, if mom doesn't have the opportunity to be vaccinated, let's say she delivers before 32 weeks, or she delivers for 14 days have passed, tell us a little bit more about the RSV monoclonal that's available to protect baby.
Yeah, this is one of those examples where we have different products that aren't just different because they're given to different ages, they're different fundamentally. So if mom delivers before 32 weeks or doesn't want to get vaccinated, or does get vaccinated, but within 2 weeks goes on to have the baby, we know that that baby is still at risk. And so what we have for the baby is not actually a vaccine, although sometimes we get sloppy and call it that. It's technically an immunization. It's a monoclonal, that means it targets one thing, antibody. It's the very thing we're trying to generate through a vaccine. But in this regard, what was done is that you take people who have had RSV, navigated it well, you find those B cells that make antibodies, and you purify the antibodies that are really awesome at destroying RSV. And then we make that antibody, and then it's in a way just filling up that baby's immunologic gas tank by giving them the very thing that a vaccine could induce, giving them the very thing that would be transferred from mom to baby if mom had been vaccinated. And right now we have two products. One's called nirsevimab. One is called clesrovimab. Both end in MAB. That stands for monoclonal antibody. And there are hundreds of these antibodies now. They're very safe. They can be very effective. And for RSV, they result in anywhere between 60 to 80% reduction in the frequency of hospitalization after getting RSV. And that's on par with what we see with moms getting vaccinated. So it's a highly effective way. We give it soon after birth. And some of these babies who go on to have complications of congenital heart disease or chronic lung disease because they were preemies, they actually get another dose their second year. So these are very effective tools that we have: vaccinate mom or provide an antibody to the baby.
And that reduction in hospitalization can't be understated. I mean, it's incredibly traumatic for families when their baby has to be hospitalized. Lots of concern and worry goes into that. And so you want to avoid that if you can, for sure. I know you're doing additional work around RSV protections. What do you see as the outstanding questions that we still need to be thinking about? What do you see as sort of the next steps? What's on the horizon as far as RSV?
Yeah, this is really important because there's probably three things that I think are very critical. Number one is we've got to figure out exactly how frequently we need to offer RSV vaccine for older adults. So I've hinted that we don't need to forget about the grandparents. And when we vaccinate grandparents, we're also protecting those babies and even those moms and dads by cocooning them. So there is an RSV vaccine. There's three to choose from in older adults. We don't yet know exactly how frequently to give that vaccine. It's probably going to be every 3 to 5 years, but we're having to do more research around that. Number two is we're really trying to provide greater clarity, especially for high-risk kids, about whether or not there could be some benefit to both the mom getting vaccinated and the baby getting one of these monoclonal antibodies. There may be some children, like the really small preemie, or the child with very complicated congenital heart disease, who might benefit from both. And then the third one is we still need an RSV vaccine for little kids. We need a vaccine or an antibody. Both strategies might work for kids who are going to go on to have cancer chemotherapy needs, or those who are immunocompromised for some other reason, or those who continue to have complex medical care problems. I think it's really important to just put numbers around this too. In the most recent trial, which happened to be the clesrovimab clinical trial, they compared, the people who make clesrovimab compared getting this monoclonal antibody, and they compared it to placebo. I think that's really important for parents to understand that we do placebo-controlled trials. We do them all the time. And this is an example of that, where there were like 3,000 infants enrolled. A couple of thousand of them got the medicine, about 1,000 of them didn't. And if you look at how many got a RSV lower respiratory tract infection, meaning they got kind of like a pneumonia from it, it was 6.5% of those kids. That's a big number. That's almost 1 in 10. It's about 1 in what? 1 in 15 or so. They got an RSV lower respiratory tract infection, 6.5%. If you compare that to the group that got the medicine, the clesrovimab, that was only 2.5%. That's a huge reduction when all we're doing is giving the antibody. So one of the things that we want to be able to do is extend that benefit, not just to babies, but to other kids who struggle with RSV as well.
You talked a little bit about cocooning the newborn, the concept of making sure that those caring for the baby have been immunized for other things like pertussis and flu, RSV, if they're eligible. Can you talk a little bit more about why that's important and what vaccinations people should look for?
Yeah, I think there's two things to say about this. One is the cocooning directly for things that a bunch of different people can get in the family. So influenza, the best way to prevent a 3 or 4 or 5 month old from getting influenza is to make sure everybody in that family unit that lives in the house or is frequently at the house, like grandparents, are vaccinated against flu. Will that be 100%? Gosh, no. Our flu vaccine needs to be so much better, but it's better than not being vaccinated. Second would be pertussis. We recognize that moms get pertussis boosting to protect the baby as they're starting to make their own response to the vaccine. We also need to remember that teenagers should be getting Tdap. Older adults, way to protect that baby, because if that baby doesn't have the perfect immune response yet, but they never see pertussis because those around them are vaccinated, then we're in a good space. And we can extend that to other diseases as well, but it starts to come more indirect protection. And what I mean by that is the following. Kids I worry about most right now, as we start to have more cases of measles, is those who are in the first year of life, whose mom's antibodies are going down, because that's what they do once they're born, but they haven't yet been vaccinated. And those are the kids who are going to have the highest risk for pneumonia and brain inflammation and blindness and all of the things that we sometimes see with severe measles infection. The best way to prevent that individual infant from getting measles is to make sure everybody in the family has been vaccinated against measles. So I think we're in a really interesting time right now where most people in most communities have the luxury of adopting kind of an alternative vaccine schedule or maybe avoiding certain vaccines, primarily because everybody around them is vaccinated. As the rates of vaccine refusal goes up, we're going to see more and more cases because that cocooning is going to fail. So the best thing we can do for an individual family is cocoon as best we can because that safety net beyond that immediate cocoon is starting to falter.
That makes total sense. Let's move on to hepatitis B and the birth dose. Why was it recommended to be administered in the first 24 hours of life to begin with? And what does the data tell us in the effectiveness in prevention of transmission of hepatitis B? And then what are the long-term effects of hepatitis B anyway? Why should we care?
Yeah, you know, sometimes we in medicine don't communicate very effectively. That's a no-brainer for most people. I don't think anybody is shocked by that statement, but we could do better. What is hepatitis B vaccine? It's a cancer prevention vaccine, period. It prevents liver cancer. Why would I not want a cancer-preventing vaccine? But we don't talk like that. We talk about hepatitis B. What's hepatitis B? Well, it's primarily spread through sexual activity and through blood transfusions or sharing of needles. Well, my baby, my granddaughter in this case, is not going to be sharing needles with anybody. Does she really need a hepatitis B vaccine? Here's a hot take. She doesn't just yet. Her mom, my daughter, doesn't have hepatitis B. She has no risk factors for hepatitis B and in fact was vaccinated against hepatitis B. Is it crucial that my granddaughter got hepatitis B vaccine in the first 24 hours of life? In that scenario, no. And if my daughter had said, I think we're going to wait for a day or two, fine. I'll totally accept that. If she said, we're going to wait for a month or two, fine. I'll totally accept that. If she said, I'm going to wait maybe a year or 5 or 10, that makes me more emotional because I don't know whether they're going to travel and increase risk. I don't know if, God forbid, she would ever need a blood transfusion, even though those are screened. So I want to be very thoughtful about how much leeway we give there. But why is it important and why did we recommend it in the first place within the first 24 hours? First is because we don't know all the time the people who are at risk or who have hepatitis B. That's a really big issue. There are people sitting out there who simply don't know that they have hepatitis B because it's silent. And that's an important piece of the puzzle. The second piece of the puzzle is that by giving that birth dose, it's highly, highly, highly effective in preventing transmission from mom to baby when there is hepatitis B present. So I think the recommendations when everything settles out are going to be, if you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that a family does not have hepatitis B, that means in the siblings and in both of the parents, those who are providing direct care for the baby, is there a high risk for the baby? No. Is it okay if they delay it? Sure. We can work with families on that. From a population level, will we continue to recommend it at birth? Absolutely. It's the best way to get people protected, and it's the best way to avoid missing kids who, if they get infected, have a high likelihood of not clearing the virus and developing liver cancer as a result.
Yeah, I think about the mom who's tested in the first trimester, right? I mean, you don't necessarily know. She knows her own personal risk to some extent, but you know that we're going to have cases missed if we have a real downtrend in the birth dose.
Exactly.
So moving on to the next topic, which is, and I know you have done a lot of work around vaccine hesitancy. I have noticed sort of a blanket refusal of all things that has crept up over the years where it's no longer just, I don't want the Hep B. It's, I don't want anything. I don't want the vitamin K. I don't want the erythromycin eye ointment. I don't want you to do vital signs on my baby. I mean, it can get really to be where, you know, nothing is allowed. So how do you start that conversation when, and make sure that people truly are educated to the point where you feel like they're you really have shared decision making, that you've opened that conversation and they're not just coming from a place of no for everything?
I think this is one of the hardest things that we do. And maybe I have a few ideas that we'll see if they're right as we deploy them. One of those is to avoid shame and blame. I think we need to recognize that we probably want the same thing, except in extraordinarily weird situations. We both want the health of that child. The problem is we have vastly different approaches sometimes to how to get there. And so one of the things that I will start with is I'll start from a position of respecting the fact that they are the parent and I am not. And at the end of the day, I want to be a trusted advisor, emphasis on trusted, but also emphasis on advisor. I can't tell them what to do, and I need to avoid a power dynamic that implies that I am telling them what to do. People bristle at that. And then the second one is that they've got to trust what I'm bringing to them. And right now, people are struggling to trust the establishment. They're struggling to trust so-called experts. They're struggling to trust those who made recommendations during the pandemic in particular that they actually felt were contrary to their deeply held beliefs. And so some of the strategies that I will deploy will be things like expressing intellectual humility, where we say things like, I recognize that there is still much to learn about these things, but here's where I land. Let me tell you about some of the things that I've learned about hepatitis B or about the eye ointment or about vitamin K and try to educate. But this is not primarily an education deficit for many people. It's an issue of who do they believe, whether they can change their mind and still save face. So give them a reason to change their mind. Give them a value proposition that makes vaccination or vitamin K or antimicrobial eye ointment to be compelling. Let's talk about why we do it. But even more important than all of those things, ask why. Why is that? Well, because I've heard that blank. Then we've got to be prepared on the fly to have a conversation about that issue that they have. And it may require multiple visits. It may require, you know, I haven't had a lot of people describe that. Can I take a little bit and get back with you? Because I really want to answer these questions if I can. I think that's fair. I think the even better approach is to say, I have heard that complaint or that concern or that question multiple times, and I've actually done some reading about it. Can I share with you what I've learned? Invite a conversation. I think when people find out that we're not scared to actually talk about these things and that we don't have to be overly paternalistic, I think people are going to respond to that if we can be compelling. The challenge is getting education. So I point people to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia website, the Vaccine Education Center there. I point them to the Monroe Carroll Children's Hospital at Vanderbilt website around perinatal care so that if there are questions and concerns there, I point them to the AAP so that they can have resources there and to a variety of other places that we can put in the show notes where what we're looking for is the information needed to say the following. You have heard it said that vitamin K has the following side effects, but I tell you that I've reviewed this and here's what we actually know. I think parents feel better when we're not afraid to have that conversation.
I also think it's super important that we recognize that the parents are the expert in their child. And so we maybe have some expertise around these topics, but we absolutely need to acknowledge their autonomy and their expertise. And I love that you have those sources that you would steer parents to. Are there some that you would say are particularly red flags that you would want to avoid?
Well, there are. And the problem is sometimes those websites look a whole lot like websites that we would use that may not have to do with immunizations like we would say, but they have some of the same words. And that can get really kooky. And the challenge is it's sort of like playing whack-a-mole in terms of which ones are red flags right now, which ones are still up, which ones are being taken out. I think that right now where we see most disinformation is from non-medical or loosely medically affiliated individuals through social media. And because the social media algorithms tend to put us in a corner of the internet that it's hard to get out of, we've got to be really careful if we have families who are relying on social media platforms for the majority of their information. So as archaic as it sounds to send people to a website, or to use a website ourselves to learn some things, I think it is important for us to come ready with that information and to even share that. And maybe one of the ways we say that, most parents still remember the times when Twitter, now X, had a 140 character limit. And one way that I've shared with parents is to say, vaccines and your baby's health, that's just more complicated than 140 characters. Let me give you some places to go that treat it for the importance that it is and can give you the information that you need. And I'll give some examples. I'll say things like, there are great sites at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Vaccine Education Center in particular that will ask the question, are there aborted fetal cells in any of the vaccines? Or will ask the question, what happens if I don't eat pork? Can I still get a vaccine that has gelatin in it? Or questions that are just absurdly practical. And I think that's really good for parents to hear because I think they want answers. They don't know where to get them right now. And they feel like they can't trust anybody. So they'll just trust the closest and loudest voice near them. I think the final thing I want to say about this particular issue that I don't want to forget is that I think we have to be mindful the incredible peer pressure that many of our moms especially are experiencing around vaccine hesitancy. In some circles, it's getting more and more challenging to say, oh yeah, I got all the things. I got vaccinated. Yes, they're on a regular schedule, even though north of 85% of people still use a traditional AAP recommended vaccine schedule. So even though it's the minority, in many people's experiences, it feels like the loudest voice out there.
That is a very, very interesting point. Are we starting to see more vaccine preventable diseases in Tennessee or around the country? Are there things that, I mean, we've all heard about the measles popping up and pertussis. Are, You feel like we're starting to see more of that?
We are, but I don't know how much of that is the normal ebb and flow. Measles, we've certainly seen an increase, but those are pockets of infection that often start from closed communities. You know, for example, the one in Texas began with a Mennonite community that was under-vaccinated. So I think we have to be a little careful not to say, like Chicken Little, that the sky is falling. Because when the sky doesn't actually fall, we're going to lose some credibility. I think what we can say is we're going to have unnecessary cases of measles. We're going to have unnecessary complications of measles like pneumonia and blindness and encephalopathy and seizures. And so we've got to be mindful of that. I think we're going to fill our hospitals with vaccine-preventable infections, and that's going to prevent us from caring for complex care kids, kids with acute behavioral health needs that need to be hospitalized, and folks that need surgical repairs of congenital abnormalities. And that's an important piece of it. But I'll also say that inevitably, as vaccine rates decrease, we will see an increase in especially some of those infections. We see it with pertussis, mainly because our pertussis vaccine could be a little more effective. It's not quite as effective as the old school wholesale vaccine that many of us got as kids, but my goodness, it's so much safer. We're going to continue to see flu, and when folks don't avail themselves of a flu vaccine, yeah, we're going to have worse years than others. The biggest one I think that we're all concerned about are going to be hepatitis B because of those breakthrough cases that we learn nothing about until they're much, much older and they have hepatitis B infection that we identify. And it's going to be measles where unless you maintain huge rates of vaccination and immunity in a population, measles is the second most contagious virus on the planet behind smallpox, which is eradicated. So it's the first most contagious virus on the planet. We're going to have troubles with measles if we're not careful.
What's next? What do you think's next on the horizon in vaccine research in general?
This is my favorite question so far. My goodness, this is where we live and this is where we spend so much of our time thinking. I think we need to have a better flu vaccine. That's the first one I would say. We need to be able to vaccinate people every few years rather than every single year. And we need to vaccinate in such a way that doesn't depend on us guessing what strain is going to circulate. We need to do better there. And there's some really interesting technologies coming down the pike that I think would be really, really helpful for us. That's number one. Number two is if there is a silver lining to some of the, I think, chaos around vaccines right now, it's that there's a lot of innovation moving towards giving vaccines through either an intranasal or an oral or just across the skin with little microneedles. You have to imagine, parents, that the value proposition of a vaccine is kind of weird. I want to prevent you from coughing by jabbing this metal needle into your child's thigh. Like, that's weird. And so we have to teach immunology a little bit better. But at the same time, we need more intranasal vaccines. We need more oral vaccines. And those are coming. It's not just going to be rotavirus and nasal flu vaccine. And then I think the third one, which is near and dear to my heart, is we have tools never seen on the planet before in figuring out what individual cells' genes are going up or going down after a vaccine, what proteins are going up or down, what's your metabolism doing after vaccines. And we're going to be able to use those tools to interrogate those individuals who have unusual, exceedingly rare side effects from vaccines so that we can begin to understand those real side effects that rarely occur. And I think that's going to be us responding with all the force of science to say, we understand that there were some boys who got heart inflammation after COVID vaccine. We understand that there are sometimes adverse events that occur after a variety of vaccines. We are thankful that they are super rare. We want to understand even those super rare things better. So we're working hard to do that. And I think this is only the beginning of what could be a real golden age of prevention of infectious diseases.
That would be wonderful. We want to thank you for all of your innovative work around vaccinations, immunizations. Many infants are alive today because of the work that's been done. So it's really important. We thank you. What else do we need to know before we let you go?
Well, I think we live in some really weird times. And the best thing that we can do is realize that life comes in cycles and there are certainly ups and downs. And depending on where you are in a political spectrum or depending on what line of work folks are in, specifically, this can be a challenging time. But at the end of the day, we need to find common ground. We need to be curious. We need to be intellectually humble. We need to invite conversation. And I think in medicine, we need to model what it looks like to say two people can disagree and we can find common ground. And I'm going to encourage the group to read a couple of books. One is The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, Haidt. Also to read The Righteous Mind by him as well. And it really lays out some really interesting things around social media for the anxious generation and around this concept of moral foundation theory, how we make decisions in the righteous mind. And then I'm going to encourage all of us to have conversations with people that we know we disagree with fundamentally. I think we learn more than we could possibly imagine by engaging with other people. And now's the time to model that.
Absolutely. Take that time, have patience, sit down, listen. All those things, right?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Creech. We appreciate you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.